Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The following causes will be submitted today. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Dutch Hines versus C.W. Hash, Jr. from Crosby County. Robert M. Bandy, administrator of the estate of Leport Walton, deceased, versus the First State Bank, Overton, Texas, from Smith County. The State of Texas and the General Land Office of Texas versus Swag Redford Oil Company from Travis County, combined with the State of Texas, the General Land Office of Texas, and Gary Morrow versus Rutherford Oil Corporation, Conoco Incorporated, and Ladd Petroleum Corporation, also from Travis County. And Ann Richards and others versus Guadalupe Nana and others, direct appeal from Hidalgo County. The times that the court has allotted for the presentations of each of these arguments are indicated on our submission schedule. The counsel are aware of that. Petitioner's counsel may reserve a stipulated amount of time for rebuttal argument by so advising our bailiff. We will complete arguments in all but the last cause this morning, and then the last calls will be argued at 2 o'clock this afternoon, and that will complete our submission schedule for the day. All of these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Hines versus Hash.
May it please the court, Mr. Rush Wells will present argument for petitioner. Mr. Wells has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please support. Rob. This case arises out of an appeal from the 72nd District Court of Crosby County through the 7th Court of Appeals in Amarillo. The issues which I would respectfully submit to the court today is, and the core issue, is the remedy when and if sufficiency of notice under 17505 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is perceived. The sufficiency of notice has been discussed in this case at great length and could consume a tremendous amount of argument in this court's time. But I would urge this court that the core issue can be reached by dealing with what is the proper remedy when and if a deficiency of notice actually occurs. Would submit to the court that we have three lines of cases in Texas, two of which have been noted in the opinion of the Court of Appeals in Amarillo. Chief Justice Reynolds noted in his opinion that they stand in direct conflict with Howe Insurance. Amarillo is relying on the Sunshine-Dotson case in 1983 opinion, which he wrote. Chief Justice still relies on that opinion and has very strongly indicated his reticence to vary from it at all. That opinion indicates that at the very first time on appeal, abatement can be raised. All of the opinions that I have been able to bring to bear on this have indicated a uniformity within the state of Texas in holding that abatement, if brought to the attention of the court prior to trial, is the proper remedy if there is a deficiency of notice under 17505.
Abatement at what stage of the proceedings, though, at the trial level or the appellate level?
At the trial level, I would respectfully submit. Mr. Justice Gonzalez, if Rule 175, the rules of procedure, is to have effect at the trial level, then we must determine pretrial motions and all pretrial dilatory matters. And a plea in abatement is such a dilatory matter, has been so held by a number of courts, and should, I respectfully submit, be treated as such. And failure to raise and set, thereby bringing it to the trial court's attention, constitutes waiver and has been so held in Howe Insurance.
It was brought to the court's attention here. Was it not at the trial court level?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
There were no motions?
There was no plea and abatement filed, Your Honor.
But the matter that the DQP knows was insufficient was made known to the trial court in some fashion?
It was pled as an affirmative defense and raised to the court's attention only after plaintiffs rested. The El Paso Court of Appeals has held that special exceptions are a remedy if brought to the court's attention prior to trial, thereby honoring Rule 175. All other courts of appeals have developed under Cable, a 1983 opinion out of this court, which was followed by Poole versus Saltgrass, Startell, and finally Howe Insurance. Howe Insurance being the case which Chief Justice Reynolds found to be in direct conflict with his holding in this case.
Counsel, let me clarify a few things. First of all, was the notice letter properly addressed?
The notice letter was addressed properly. At the trial, it was a copy of the telephone directory of Crosbyton, Texas, a relatively small rural town, was referred to by the witnesses. The copy of the letter came in without objection. The letter was sent.
Certified mail?
Was sent certified mail, and the record will reflect that there were three notices sent to the individual by the U.S. Post Office, and it was returned unclaimed.
Was the green card entered into evidence?
The green card was not entered into evidence because the green card had no real relevance since it was returned unclaimed. It has been suggested in the argument at the Seventh Court of Appeals that various rather arcane methods be used, personal service couriers, actual citation, to deliver these. Chief Justice Reynolds, in the oral arguments, which do not appear in his opinion, suggested sending first-class mail. But there again, the discussion developed, and this is brought out in my application for writ, that the exact same remedies are going to apply there, because first-class mail, while it is presumed to be delivered, can be denied, and you can deny receipt. Where does that leave us? If this court will address the issue and merely tell us, and I would urge the court to so tell, all a defendant must do to bring it to the court of the trial court's attention is to file a plea and abatement, a very efficient way of handling this. I would represent to the court that at the present time, after arguing this in Amarillo, I have two pending in West Texas, one in Daniels County and one in Hockley County, both of which I'm in a defense position, have raised a plea and abatement very quickly, very inexpensively to my client, rendering notice and an opportunity to cure, which is what 17.44 says the purpose of the act is. It says, this subchapter shall be liberally construed and applied to promote its underlying purposes, which are to protect consumers against false, misleading, and deceptive business practices, unconscionable actions, and breaches of warranty, and to provide efficient and economical procedures to secure such protection. A petition is filed. A defendant noticed that there is a deficiency of notice. An abatement is part of his answer, a very brief plea and abatement, filed with the court can secure him all of his rights to cure, to protect himself against multiple damages and against attorney's fees. To hold, as we have in this case in Amarillo, that either a plaintiff must abate his own case, or that we go through the entire trial, complete with submissions to a jury, a return on the jury issues, and then go to the appellate level and abate that cause back, can do nothing but clog the court system.
That may be, but Section 1750A makes giving of notice, quote, a prerequisite the filing suit. Why isn't that language against you in this case?
The language is, but if the court will deal with what needs to happen if there is a deficiency, and the courts of appeals and this court under Cale have held that it does not defeat an action to have a deficiency of notice. It merely can defeat certain subparts of the rights of recovery. And we're saying, as the court held in Howe Insurance, that those can be fully protected through the simple act of a plea of abatement, which affords the defendant all of his rights, which he would have ever had, very economically and very efficiently.
I understand your argument on the plea and abatement, but referring to Section 17.505, which is the amended version of 1758, it says, shall give written notice. My question to you is, when you sent the letter, certified mail, and the United States Post Office notified the other side three times that the letter was waiting, does that constitute giving notice?
And I have argued that in my application. Because of the time constraints of the argument at the podium, I chose to try and limit that issue. I have raised that in the application for writ and the presumptions that arise upon depositing and what was said during the trial with respect to lack of actual physical receipt of the letter.
Was there any evidence in the record why the defendant chose not to pick up the letter?
Yes, sir.
What do you say in that regard?
What did he say?
Yes.
He said that he was busy on a contracting job and that he did not have an opportunity to go by and pick up his mail.
He didn't say, I knew I was being sued and I don't want to pick it up? I think there might be trouble for me? He didn't say that?
No, sir, he did not say that.
Any other questions?
Over what period of time were these deliveries attempted?
2 weeks.
He didn't pick up his mail for 2 weeks?
He did not pick up his certified mail 2 weeks. That is correct.
Did he
what
pick up...
What's a DTPA complainant to do or claimant to do if he attempts good faith effort to give notice over a period of time and unable to do so?
That is why, in the opportunity I had to speak to the court this morning, I chose to deal with the cure if there is a deficiency. Because if we have someone avoiding their mail, avoiding their notice, let's file the suit, and then it can be abated. If he actually is a good faith defendant, attempting to settle, attempting to cure, to limit his damages, then he will have all of those rights afforded him by the simple act of the
In other words, the notice requirement is to promote settlement so that these matters won't be litigated. That's one of the basic purposes in this notice requirement. Here's the claim I have against you. If we don't get into some settlement discussion pretty quick, then I'm going to file suit against you. If someone avoids this kind of notice and go ahead and file a suit, if they are good faith, they can abate the proceedings and proceed with settlement discussions. Is that correct?
And also, by making these offers, if they are substantially in accordance with what the court finally finds, limit their liability at the same time, very quickly and efficiently. They've lost nothing, and we have overcome the situation of a prospective defendant or defendant who is avoiding the notice.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ralph Brock, to present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Wells, Mr. Warnick. This is not a deficiency of notice case, as counsel has characterized it. As the argument developed later on, it's clear that no notice was given in this case. And I say that even though he did mail the letter, because and I've discussed this in my brief, the cases say that when the legislature requires notice to be given in a statute but does not prescribe the manner in which the notice is to be given, then actual receipt of that notice is required before notice is effective. Therefore,
counsel, was the evidence that your client picked up some of his mail but didn't pick up his certified mail?
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence was that he went to work, I think, about 6 in the morning, returned about 7 in the evening. Post office was closed when he went to work, so he couldn't get it then. It was closed when he came home from where he was working out of town.
So he received the notice of the certified mail, and he knew it was there, but he just didn't ever get around to picking it up.
Yes, Your Honor, and he testified further that he was recently divorced and had no one else that could go to the post office for him to pick it up. He also testified that there was nothing that he knew of that indicated that this was a demand letter, that he was fixing to be sued in a DTPA action or anything like that. In other words, there's counsel characterized this as avoiding notice, but there's no evidence in the record that he was avoiding notice.
Counsel, we're talking about the remedy here, aren't we, in case of a failure of notice or a deficient notice where notice is attempted or whether it's not attempted. The question is that once suit is filed, what the appropriate remedy for a defendant is. Why was a plea in abatement not filed in this case? It would have been the better practice in the name of judicial economy if there was going to be a good faith effort to settle and negotiate. Why wait until the plaintiff has put on his entire case and rested and then spring an affirmative defense of failure of notice?
Well, we didn't spring it on them, first of all, Your Honor. This was pleaded in our answer. It was raised with motion for instructed verdict twice. It was raised in motion of judgment NOV, raised again in our motion for new trial. It was discussed. It's on the record. It was discussed during the course of trial whether or not the case should be abated. The trial court decided not to. But in,
did you request an abatement?
No, Your Honor. Well, I'm not sure if we did or not, to tell you the truth. I don't believe we did. But
why does that not constitute a waiver?
Because our contention is that failure to give notice is an element of the plaintiff's cause of action. And when he failed to give notice, his cause of action was barred, just like a number of other statutory causes of action where notice is a requirement before filing suit, like the Tort Claims Act. Or
did he plead notice, counsel?
Pardon?
Did he plead notice?
No, he specifically pleaded that he had sent the letter and the letter had been returned. It's almost pleading himself out of court because he said we sent the letter and the letter was returned and the defendant did not receive notice.
What else would you have him do to accomplish notice in the event someone in your client's position declines to pick up certified mail?
Well, first of all, I would disagree with your characterization that he declined to pick it up because the evidence is undisputed that he was unable to. But beyond that, our position...
It's transcredulity that he could not go a two-week period to pick up certified mail. I mean, it just...
He's a laborer. He's a contractor.
So what? Does he have any friends, family, relatives?
The undisputed evidence is that he didn't. I don't know, but that's the undisputed evidence, Your Honor.
Mr. Brock, if your client were a medical doctor accused of professional misconduct instead of a roofing contractor accused of roofing malpractice, there wouldn't be any question under the decision that you talk about in your brief of this court, near unanimous decision of your court, of this court, that abatement would be the appropriate remedy.
That's the Sheps case, Your
right.
Honor? That's a different situation because...
Well, you agree that there's no question that for medical doctors, abatement is the appropriate remedy when they're accused of misconduct.
Under that case, yes, Your Honor.
All right, and that statute was interpreted in that opinion by this court as being mandatory.
Yes, Your Honor.
That you shall, the language is you shall give notice 60 days in advance in that case. Even though it doesn't use the term prerequisite, it's a mandatory notice. It's a shall command of the legislature, and yet the court said the remedy in that situation is abatement, not a bar. Why does it make any sense for us to treat roofing contractors who commit malpractice any differently than physicians who commit malpractice?
They're two different statutes, first of all, but the language in the DTPA is as a prerequisite to filing suit, and I believe that puts it in the category of the Tort Claims Act cases and the Home Rule City cases where the notice is a requirement.
Is there any notice statute that does not, though, it's fairly hard for a city or a state to hide.
That's true.
Is there any notice statute that has been interpreted by our courts that in a
in an action against a private individual or
yes,
a company
Honor.
Where if the notice is not actually delivered, that's a prerequisite to file.
Yes, Your Honor, the attorney fees statute where presentment, I'm analogizing that to notice, but you have to present
and
your
so
claim.
But what about all our cases that say that can be raised up to the time of trial and can be handled by pleadings?
Well, because the statute in this case requires the notice to be given at that time 30 days, now 60 days in advance, and there is no such requirement in the attorney fees statute. There's a number of mechanics and materials lien statutes that require the notice to be given before any action is brought, and failure to give notice bars the action. So those are cases against private individuals. That,
counsel, isn't your filing of your claim at the county courthouse notice under the mechanics lien statute?
My understanding,
doesn't require personal service on them.
Your Honor, I frankly don't know. I don't do a mechanics materials lien practice, and that's something I've deliberately stayed away from. I do know that the notice is required. Whether filing the claim at the courthouse is sufficient or not, I frankly can't answer that.
Counsel, if your client's residence, if he lived at a home and got his mail there, and he refused to come to the door to accept the certified letter, then under your theory, there would never be notice. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. There are alternative ways of doing this. I don't understand really what the problem is, because thousands of DTA plaintiffs all across the state manage to get their notice served on defendants or potential defendants every day. There's lots of ways of doing it. He could walk up and hand it to him, and that would be adequate notice, I believe. He could mail it. Counsel has denigrated first-class mail, but he could mail it first-class and get one of these certificates of mailing from the post office, which is a lot cheaper than certified mail for that matter. And that certifies that a letter was mailed by this person to this addressee on this date, and they stamp it with their little postal stamp, and it costs about 45 cents to do that. And that's evidence that the letter was mailed, and then you have the presumption that it was received. You could send the certified letter.
And you could also have the testimony that he never received it.
Yes, Your Honor, you could send
the certified letter. Where does that leave us?
You can send the certified letter and the first-class letter, and if the certified letter came back and the first-class letter didn't, then you've got a fairly strong presumption.
I'm talking about moving beyond the presumption. There's still a defendant can get on the stand and say, I never received it.
He could.
So where does that leave us?
It might leave us with a jury question at that point. You know, I just don't know. But at some point, the issue would have to be resolved, certainly. But as I say, other plaintiffs have managed to do it throughout the state. And I go back to what I said earlier, that when the legislature requires notice and doesn't specify how that notice is to be given, then the notice there has to be actual receipt one way or the other. And it's up to the plaintiff to find a way to do this. It's not up to the defendant. And I think there's ways to do it and avoid a swearing match in court.
Counsel, did your client ever make a settlement offer in this case?
We never had an opportunity to, Your Honor.
You haven't had an opportunity since this litigation began?
Well, if we had, it's not in the record. Because the first notice that we had was the filing of the lawsuit.
Let me ask you, have you had a chance to consider the amicus brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the amicus makes the point that not every error in a trial results in reversal. You've got to show harm. Tell us what harm your client has incurred here in the absence of any settlement offer in the record.
I'm not sure I understand the question. As I understand the amicus brief, he
What harm has your client incurred due to the failure to receive the notice that you say he's entitled to?
We've gone through an entire trial on the merits. We've gone through an appeal to the Court of Appeals in Amarillo, and now we're up here on an application for writ of error.
And you say that could all be avoided if you'd been given an opportunity to make a settlement offer.
That's the purpose of the notice requirement.
But yet there's no settlement offer as part of the record in the case, or no showing that you've been given the opportunity at some point during the course of this litigation.
Well, Your Honor, our contention, as I've said earlier, is that the failure to give notice, we believe, is a failure of his entire cause of action. If he didn't give the notice, then that cause of action is barred as a matter of law, just as it would be under the Tort Claims Act or Home Rule City Act or mechanics and terminals lien situations. So we felt like... Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt. You told me a moment ago that you raised this before in your pleadings, presumably in your original answer.
Yes, Your Honor.
before the case went to trial, before the plaintiff put on his case. So obviously, when you were, your client was served with petition, with the suit, plaintiff's petition, plaintiff's pleadings, you had notice that there was claim there. And you filed an answer raising failure of notice. And that did, there was no opportunity to discuss settlement or make a settlement offer before the case went to trial. How long was it before the after the defendant was served with the plaintiff's pleadings before the case went to trial?
Offhand, I'm not sure, Your Honor. I know there were the plaintiff filed several amended pleadings, so it apparently was a fairly several months.
But there was no opportunity to make a settlement offer.
There was if we had wanted to do that, I'm sure, Your Honor. But our contention is we didn't have to at that point. That the cause of action was barred because he did not give the prerequisite.
The difference between taking the position that you don't have to and not having the opportunity to. One, you were saying you didn't have the opportunity.
Yes, Your Honor. We didn't have the opportunity under the legislative scheme, which is to avoid litigation. In other words, if we take this position, we might as well write the notice requirement out of the statute, because if no plaintiff is going to bother to give notice, if he can take the chance that the defendants will either not raise it in plea and abatement or go ahead and make the settlement offer afterwards once you get into litigation, what's the point of having the notice statute on the books anyway?
Well, isn't the point of it to, in the event that notice is not sent and a defendant wants to cure without incurring extensive litigation costs, to give them an opportunity to do that before discovery crossfire starts occurring between the parties?
I believe that's correct, and that's what we were denied, Your Honor.
Well, you could, if you had simply filed a plea and abatement instead of your or with your answer, you would have had a period of time there in which to do the cure, if you had one, before any other legal expenses were incurred.
That's perhaps true, but I don't think that that's what the legislature intended. Why that shifts the burden back to us. If you look at the legislative history, or the history of the DTPA in 1977, when they first put the notice requirement in the statute, the burden was on the defendant to affirmatively plead that he had not received notice. In 1979, the statute was written essentially the way it reads now, that it is a prerequisite to filing suit. That shifts the burden to the plaintiff. Now, the scheme that we're talking about now shifts the burden back to the defendant to not only plead lack of notice, but plead an abatement and that sort of thing. Our contention is that the plaintiff has to carry some of the weight. He has to do something right before this litigation ever gets started, and that is give the notice and not just sit back and say, well, I'm not going to give notice or it's inconvenient for me to try to give a second notice and see what the defendant does. That's our position.
Isn't the whole scheme of these things, though, to have these issues resolved on the merits?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think that the scheme is to encourage settlement prior to ever filing the lawsuit. That's not necessarily resolving it on the merits. That may be an expedient way out of avoiding
certain
litigation.
Certainly, it's not a procedural log to hide behind, though, is it?
I'm sorry?
It's not a procedural log to hide behind. That's not the point of the statute. That's not the point of notice. The point of notice is to have these things resolved amicably without litigation on the merits, if possible.
That's
so
correct.
So that all parties walk away a little happier than they will after a lawsuit.
Yes, Your Honor. And this is a situation where the plaintiff sent out one letter and said, I've done all I've got to do, and I don't really believe that's what the statute contemplated. This wasn't a situation where he was right up against the statute of limitations or anything like that. He could have made other efforts to give the statutorily required notice before he filed the suit, and he elected not to do that. Does the court have any other questions?
Counsel, looking at 17.505, it says, shall give written notice. Okay?
Yes.
It does not say shall give actual notice.
That's correct.
Any other questions?
Pardon?
I was asking the court if there are any other questions.
Your Honor, if I might respond to that comment, I go back to the cases that I've cited in my brief where the statute says the party has to give notice if the statute doesn't prescribe how the notice is to be given. A lot of times the statute will say by certified mail. In this case it doesn't. Then the cases have said that the other party has to receive notice, even though the statute doesn't. The cases say that he has to receive the notice before it will be considered effective. I might mention, just before I close, that the Cale decision, which says that delivery of a written notice is a prerequisite to recovery, was decided at almost the same time as the Sheps case and the Hutchison versus Wood case. In fact, I didn't check the dates, that they were both, or all three of them were in 1983. I think that if the court had wanted to extend the Shep rationale to the DTPA, that would have been the opportune time to do it, and the court apparently elected not to and treated the DTPA cases as a different type of case.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel.
If the court does have no other questions, we would ask the court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and render judgment that the plaintiff take nothing. Alternatively, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals remanding the case in order to be abated. Thank you.
Mr. Brock has told this court that the plaintiff has to do something right. In litigation, the burden shifts back and forth in constant flow. We did something right. Mr. Warnick wrote a letter. He came back. He filed a lawsuit. He and I tried a lawsuit. We did something right.
Brock says that if you take your position, might as well not go to the trouble to give the notice. What's your response to that?
I don't have the wisdom of Solomon to tell this court how to distinguish between good and bad faith efforts. That is the reason that I said that we could be here a very long time on dealing with sufficiency of notice. But probably someday, at least at some point, it must be dealt with when good faith attempts have been made.
Well, you're surely not suggesting that if there's a good faith attempt made, the remedy is abatement. But if it's a bad faith attempt, then you can raise it on appeal and get it reversed.
No, that is not right. We've got to have a remedy. Deceptive trade practices suits are exploding in this state. The law is in conflict. We've got to have a ruling from this court as to how to tame them down and how to handle them at the trial level.
My question to you, though, simply is, if you take your position that the sole remedy is abatement, why would a plaintiff even bother to give notice?
I do not have a good answer for the court on that.
Counsel, assuming that all parties are acting in good faith, that there's a good faith from the plaintiff's perspective, legitimate claim from the defendant's perspective that there's a good faith defense, good faith effort that delivering notice is made, a good faith inability to receive notice or some failure of notice, not based on bad faith, the part of the defendant occurs. What is the appropriate remedy in order to assure that that person has a notice and pursuant to the intent of the statute has an opportunity to make an offer or at least enter into some negotiations and settlement?
It has occurred to me, with respect to Justice Heck, as you were speaking, that those two relate. If we have a plea of abatement, that can be the cure. And if we have a bad faith action on the part of the individual in failing to even attempt notice when such is practical, we have Rule 13. So that may be an answer or a way of dealing with it, to not only abate the case, but Rule 13 thereby allowing the defendant who feels that no good faith has been exercised and it's been a bad faith filing of pleadings to recover even his expenses through the trial court's discretion up to the level of filing the abatement and thereby preserving his rights.
you're arguing that plea and abatement is the only remedy that a plaintiff would have, or defendant would have, to legitimately in good faith pursue the merits, or he can procedurally lay behind the law, come up after the plaintiff's stated his case, and then assert that the failure of notice, when he obviously has notice in actuality by the time the case goes to trial, by the time it's litigated, at any point along, there's no requirement really that they do all of the offering and negotiating prior to trial, but it's an effort to avoid trial if the notice is far.
Exactly.
Plea and abatement accommodates that.
Exactly. The plea and abatement accommodates it. And to go even further with what, and I wouldn't presume to say what the court is thinking, but if we
to assert failure of notice as an affirmative defense and have the plaintiff poured out after he's put on his case doesn't address the merits of the case at all, does it?
It does not. And if we have terribly bad faith, we could even throw the suit out under Rule 13 and the sanctions to flow down from that under 250. So that may be a way to address this text. Questions on it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience.